Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Robin Hessman, director of the new film My Perestroika. The film follows five ordinary Russians living in extraordinary times, from their cocoon Soviet childhood to the collapse of the Soviet Union during their coming of age, to the constantly shifting political landscape of post-Soviet Russia. Robin Hessman graduated from Brown University with a joint degree in Russian and film and went on to receive her graduate degree in film directing from the All-Russian State Institute of Cinematography in Moscow. Throughout the 1990s, she lived in Russia making documentaries and working for the Children's Television Workshop as the on-site producer of Ulitsa Sezam, the original Russian-language Sesame Street. She also co-produced the Peabody Award-winning documentary Tupperware. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robin Hessman.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And I must say, I've always had a lot of affection for Russia and spent a lot of time there during the Cold War and worked on arms control issues and confidence building and other things. And of course, I've always felt the irony was, since I was born in Australia, that the Russians and the Americans are the same people. They're both from big countries. They're very proud, and they had so much more in common than they have in. And of course, the great tragedy, which I guess is in a way a subtext of your film, was that after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the United States essentially abandoned them. And when their economy collapsed, which was a traumatic experience for them, it sort of left them with a bitter feeling. And there was a period when America was loved, and now America's not so loved, right?
Well, in the film, that it's not so much right. expressed, but certainly from my own experiences, I can say firsthand, yes, when I arrived in January of 91, there was so much excitement and affection and relief at the ending of the Cold War and the idea that world peace was at hand, and the fact that these two countries, after so many decades of animosity, could now, normal people could become friends. I think that in a little bit later in the 90s, as some of the policies that were put in place, like the voucher system in 1992, which gave ordinary citizens their first piece of, a factory or whatnot, without any real educational process, no pamphlets, no television programs, and some of the other, immediate privatization with the idea that a few incredibly wealthy people will invest back into the country. I did leave people a little disillusioned that they had been expecting a little bit more help. But there have been waves. There have been lots of waves of feelings toward Americans. I think a big turning point that I don't know if was quite recognized here was the bombing of Kosovo in 1999. That, I think, was the moment that the general Russian population, in the media, the language changed of how to look at America. And of course, since Putin has come, it hasn't gotten better. But I should say that for me, as an American who has spent quite a lot of time there, I haven't felt any direct anti-American sentiment expressed towards me. And certainly for the five protagonists of the film, really only Ruslan, the punk musician, expresses some bias against American values.
Well, of course, the punk musician was with a punk band that ended up being funded by the KGB, right?
Well, no, some of the concerts, in the very, very early days when rock music was just beginning to be allowed to come up from underground, some of the rock, like the Moscow Rock Laboratory, was funded by the KGB, but the bands themselves were always independent. The KGB just paid for some of these concert venues and locations so they could just keep an eye on right. what was going on.
Well, I recall one of the songs that he sang was a four-letter word, NATO.
Yes.
Well, at least that was one of the lines.
Yes. But of course, they were also against everybody. They're against the bourgeoisie. They're against the Soviet regime. They're against against NATO. They were kind of against all structures and all authority.
So you have one businessman mm-hmm. who has a high-end shirt retail mm-hmm. outfit where I guess the oligarchs and others shop. I mean, I imagine there's some emerging elite in Russia, not just the handful of oligarchs.
Oh, no, quite a lot of people do shop there. The shirts are about $150. I think that would be pretty low for an oligarch.
Right, but pretty high for the average Russian.
Yes, but there are many people for whom that is accessible.
Attainable. And then you've got the woman who actually did have a relationship, I don't know whether he was an oligarch, but somebody that had some money who was in the banking business, and he got shot by his rivals when in that period of gangsterism in the transition from communism to capitalism, the gangster transition, which I don't imagine is entirely over. And then you've got the two school teachers who have pretty much framed the film, right? The beginning and end of how that important day, the 1st of September.
Yes, I think of the Meyersons, Borden and Luba, as kind of the heart, and their family, their son Mark, is the heart of the film. And the 1st of September, of course, is a very important ritual in Russia. It's the first day of school. All children come with flowers for their teachers. The first graders are led into school by the graduating seniors because school there isn't divided into high school and elementary school. Everyone is together from first grade through the end of high school. And one of the littlest first graders will be picked up in the air and ring in the school bell. And this is eternal. And the film, in a sense, shows that also. This is how the film ends, and regardless of whether there's Putin or Yeltsin or Brezhnev, there are these eternal cycles of human life, and there will always be kids walking to school on the 1st of September holding their parents' hands.
You know, you mentioned earlier, Robin Hessman, how the bombing of Kosovo upset the Russians, and I recall during that period how much the Serbs are tortured by their own history, but the Russians are, of course, not just tortured, but they're burdened by their own history, and history has now become controversial again because as these two teachers, at least the history teacher, was clearly upset that Putin was now trying to erase all references to Stalin. And so that's the sad part for me, who've experienced a little bit of the bloom of perestroika and the possibility. Because we've ended the Cold War, but the missiles are still there. It's worth realizing that we have kind of psychological disarmament, but physically we could still wipe each other off the face of the earth, and nobody could do that but the Russians.
And yes, as Luba says in the film, she quotes a very famous proverb, how in Russia it's the past that's unpredictable. And there is a great tradition of constantly rewriting the past, which happens to some degree in every country. If we looked at textbooks from the 70s, we might be amused at them. But, you know, Stalin would have portraits commissioned with himself next to Lenin to look as if he were the heir apparent. And during the purges, people were erased. And today, of course, Luba is upset, and they are upset of the return of even a kind of language that they thought would not return again. She told me a story about coming to school and seeing a book called The Instruction and Methodology for Imparting Knowledge of the Russian Anthem, of, you know, the National Anthem for the Russian Federation to their students. And that kind of book, an instruction manual for how to teach your students the national anthem, she was shocked to see that. She thought that kind of language, that kind of even an idea, is something that, you know, 10 years ago she would have thought would be impossible. And so, as Borden in the film also points out, where the Soviet Union is gone and the degree of freedom of travel and information that ordinary citizens have is a far cry from what there was during the Soviet Union. But there is a return to a certain kind of language and a certain kind of approach that in the 90s people really did believe was gone forever.
Well, one of those, of course, would be Nashi, the youth group that spontaneously erupted with fealty towards Chairman Putin.
And those children, of course, they're younger. It's interesting, the kind of really fierce patriotism, in my experience, you find more with the older generation that remembers the Soviet Union and was in the peak of their adult professional life then, or the younger generation who never lived through it but heard tales of it as a mythology. But the generation of people in my film are a very interesting transition generation because they were children in the Soviet Union and had these completely normal Soviet childhoods like everyone before them. But they were young and coming of age and were teenagers when Gorbachev came to power. And that's a very key moment in the life of an adolescent at the same time that the foundations of their country were rumbling so much. And they graduated from college just the year that the country collapsed. So none of them ever were members of the party or were assigned a job to work for the rest of their lives. None of them were adults in the professional field in the Soviet Union. So they, their generation, I can't say that I've encountered a lot of that same mass kind of burning patriotism. They were the beneficiaries of the new freedoms coming just at a time that an individual is seeking new freedoms.
Of course, it felt to me like that was the irony of the film, was that they did come of age at the moment that the whole system collapsed. And the people that I used to deal with in the USA Canada Institute and others were a little older. And I always felt, once the system went away, how helpless they were, because they were sort of institutniks who had a good life. But now most of what they were doing was irrelevant, and it was all Soviet kind of academia and arms control and other things, which pretty much went away. It happened here, too. A lot of people at Rand Corporation were out of work as well. But give me a sense of this divide between the older generation who are sort of lost and the younger ones who never even knew communism coming up today, who are so much able to and better equipped to handle this kind of Wild West capitalism.
Well, the younger generation, the generation of the children in the film, they find the stories of the Soviet Union very difficult to comprehend. They can hear it intellectually, but they don't really understand what things were like. And that's something that, that many of them have remarked to me. And, you know, Borde at the end of the film says that these children today, they don't understand that at all. And he says it's very good that they don't understand it. They can't believe that someone couldn't have bought a plane ticket and travel in the Soviet Union. It is difficult to generalize, because there are such incredible transformation of a country and a generation and an individual is so incredibly complicated that as the film shows, the five of them, all of the same generation, all of people who grew up in the very same classroom, they all have completely different perspectives and interpretations of the events that happened, and in conflicting feelings within themselves from day to day. And so for the generation of their parents as well, it isn't an easy thing. I found that after living there for almost a decade and returning to the States, that many people were yearning for me to kind of package the experience and explain things in one or two phrases of what Russia was like or how people had handled the transition to capitalism. But honestly, the answers are as many as there are different people. And I know people of the older generation who are thriving now and, you know, giving lectures in dozens of countries and have a rich intellectual life that they're thrilled about, and they constantly are aware of and remembering how difficult or impossible it would have been for them to have had such a life previously. And I also have friends whose parents are in much more difficult circumstances. So there are certainly generational markers of where people fall in their own lives on the waves of these huge historical and political changes. But I'm always very hesitant to sum up the experience for one or another.
Well, then what do you think, then? It feels that that moment of liberalism, you know, there was a liberal party, there was, and of course, you know, even Putin's mentor was a great liberal in Leningrad, and now they're almost disappeared in the Duma. There's no liberal bloc, and many people think that this country is heading further to the right as well. And a lot of progressives lament the lack of cojones on the part of liberals. What happened to the Russian liberals?
Well, unfortunately, I think that democracy and capitalism were given the difficulty of the transition economically and politically were branded with the name democracy and capitalism. And so for a vast majority of the country, the messiness of that process is for them what democracy is and what capitalism is. And of course, those things are far from accurate representations.
But what about this notion that the Russians are sort of almost genetically and reflexively more comfortable with totalitarianism? That is the explanation for the failure of liberalism.
Yes, but I'm
You don't buy it.
I don't necessarily buy it. I wish that we could go back to, say, 1988 and 89 and put in some different policies at the moment of transition.
Of course.
And who's to say then if perhaps there wouldn't be an independent judiciary today or
right. they... Well, that was the point I was making earlier, that at the moment of need, the U.S. abandoned them. And they essentially... it was as if we wanted communism to totally destroy it. We gave no value to the assets of a society, both culturally and economically and physically. And the voucher system, as you pointed out, was quickly abused by gangsters and others because people didn't know what they had.
Exactly, and it just simply wasn't even set up well.
Yeah. Well, of course, now we're going to have the Republicans are offering vouchers up for healthcare. Great. It will have the same results.
Fabulous.
So tell me, just in closing then, Robin Hessman, what do you want your audiences in the United States to get from your film?
I hope that the film will reveal a world that they didn't necessarily know with all of its depth and complexities. The film is a very intimate portrait of five different people. And for those who've never been to Russia and might not ever go, I hope that this film will, in a sense, transport them to the best of its ability to both the world behind the Iron Curtain that we never had access to, the childhood of the people in the film, and what Russia's like today.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in the studio, Robin Hessman.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Robin Hessman, director of the new film, My Perestroika.